Why have we asked our contractor we found on Angie.com to be our kid's legal guardian? Because he took such good care when redoing our basement that we knew we could trust him to care for our kids, all 8 of them, should something happen to us.
Are you my dad now?
No, sorry, I do basements.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individuals participating in the podcast. This podcast also contains subject matter which may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm here with Dr. Richard Ebright and Dr. Bryce Nichols, and I am here sort of to check in. How has the last year been? You all were gracious enough to take part in the movie. You've been brave enough to speak out about this dangerous research and biosafety issues around the world. And I think since the election and the administration changing, there were a lot of high hopes for reform. And I want to just maybe start with you, Richard. What has it been like since the administration changed, and what are sort of the highlights for you of this last year that around the biosafety issue, the COVID investigation, and other matters related to that?
I would say that it's been mixed. So there was very high promise and high hope and high expectations at the start of the new administration, with key figures in the new administration about moving forward with disclosures of intelligence and information about the origin of COVID-19, seeking accountability for U.S. government personnel who are involved in the origin of COVID-19, for enhancing biosafety, enhancing biosecurity, and enhancing biorisk management. Some of those people have, in fact, moved forward and have followed up on the promise and high expectation. Others have not.
The next 4 episodes of Leaked are going to feel a little bit different, and it's definitely not a recap. The voices you're about to hear are the ones that usually stay off the record, the ones behind closed doors, in the rooms where the decisions actually get made. Right before 2026, we asked Jenner First to reconnect with people from his inner circle, scientists and experts who didn't make it into the new administration, and who might finally be willing to talk about the things they've been hearing quietly for years. You're going to hear those conversations. We're starting with Richard Ebright and Bryce Nichols, 2 scientists at the center of the biosafety debate, both with decades of experience studying how dangerous research actually fails. Together, they talk through what still isn't being said about COVID's origins, what's changed under the new administration, and what hasn't. This is what the conversation sounds like when no one's trying to win an election. Episode 5, What Still Isn't Being Said.
As far as incidents over the last year, things that have escalated, created more questions in laboratories around the world, there's been a few incidents, and I wanted to check in with you about that, 2 in particular, China and then Spain. So what do you know about these incidents, and what do you believe has happened?
So first, Newcastle disease virus. Newcastle disease virus is a very serious infection of poultry and wild birds. It is a select agent, a registered select agent in the United States, meaning that it has been identified as a virus that has high potential for use as a bioweapon in biowarfare, bioterrorism, or biocrime. It is studied in a number of laboratories worldwide at a level of biosafety called agricultural biosafety level 3. There are multiple sequences or strains of viruses that cause Newcastle disease virus. And a report was released this year that a variant of Newcastle disease virus called genotype 4, which was believed to have been extinct for multiple decades, has now appeared in wild birds sampled in multiple locations in China. The fact that a presumed extinct virus appears again in nature is immediately an alert to a possible lab release of a freezer stock, a virus that has been stored in a lab, researched in a lab, stored in a freezer, and now has escaped from the lab through accidental or deliberate release and is in wild birds, wild populations. The particular sequence that was obtained not only was a sequence of an extinct virus genotype, but also was a sequence that was essentially identical to the sequence as it existed before it became an extinct virus genotype. That means it didn't show the changes that would be expected for multiple decades if it had somehow persisted in the wild in a remote location and not been known to have persisted. It looked essentially identical to the virus that was circulating decades ago and then went extinct. If this was a laboratory release, it represents the third documented release since 2019 in China alone. There having been in 2019 in China SARS-CoV-2, which was a laboratory release, and also in 2019 in China at the same time as SARS-CoV-2, release of the bacterium Brucella, which causes the disease brucellosis, which is also in the past identified by the United States as a select agent with high potential for use in biowarfare, bioterrorism, or biocrimes. So that's one of the two incidents. Remarkably, just 1 month after the disclosures about Newcastle disease virus.
I'm going to jump in there, Jenner, to point out that there was also an incident in the U.S. that should raise alarm, which occurred, sometime before May at the Fort Detrick Integrated Research Facility. There was characterized as a lover's quarrel in a high containment laboratory in which one of the workers slashed the suit of another worker, which led to that facility being shut down.
A key difference is that action did not, as far as we know, result in an infection loss or a release of a pathogen. So that was particularly notable in that occurred in a biosafety level 4 facility operated by the United States government, specifically by the National Institutes of Health, NIH, a facility on the Fort Detrick campus in Frederick, Maryland. Those are notable features. The incident provides some insight into the lack of security, the lack of personnel screening, and the kinds of human error and human consequence problems that can be associated with biosafety.
So, Bryce, just kind of circling back to you, what have you felt and witnessed over the last year, encouraging things and discouraging things?
Well, I think Richard characterized it accurately as a mixed bag, where there's been, the positive would be there's been public statements in opposition of dangerous gain-of-function research. We had an executive order that was signed in May that was, pitched as the end to this, bioweapons research that puts everyone's life at risk. We had Donald Trump giving a speech in September in front of the United Nations where he said the U.S. would take the lead in, strengthening the bioweapons convention. These are positive signs. But what we really haven't seen is these statements are great, but the actions of actually, following through with Trump's executive order, getting a real policy that has teeth to stop the research, that hasn't happened. And I guess more troubling is some of the personnel choices are a bit, I would say, inconsistent with what one would hope would be a push towards eliminating, dangerous research. So just as an example, just asking you, Jenner, if you wanted to, eliminate or generate a culture where risky research, dangerous research was not encouraged, would you select a person who resurrected the 1918 flu, Spanish flu, as a choice to be one of the key drivers of that culture and to sort of, lead the way on eliminating dangerous research? Would that be somebody? I mean, maybe it's just me, and we've talked about this, Jenner.
Who are you referring to?
Well, no, I'm just, it's a hypothetical.
It's
just
not like hypothetical. a doctor, Anthony Kaufman,
who is the acting director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
Richard and I have a different style in the way we like to discuss.
You probably have noticed.
Right. Yes.
If you did, I'm just surprised.
I have picked up of a sort of a yin and yang between the two of you.
I'd like to be the yin. I think, I don't know if even, whichever. But yes, I'm referring to Jeffrey Taubenberger, which is an interesting choice as the head of the NIAID.
It's
the
not
National
an interesting Institute. Choice. It's a shocking choice. It's an unconscionable choice. It's an indefensible choice.
Right.
And well, who has made this choice, just to be clear?
The current NIH director, Jay Bhattacharya. And he has not only made this choice, but he has repeatedly defended this choice.
And for you all who witnessed Jay's work early on, he's fallen on the right side of the debate thus far. Do you think there's any merits to his choice? How is he? What did he say as sort of the reason why he has chosen this person to run the NIAID after Fauci?
So Jay Bhattacharya, as NIH director, since taking the position of NIH director, has said all the right things about biosafety, about biosecurity, and about biorisk management, and has taken credit for addressing each of those areas. But at the same time, as saying those things, he has not actually followed through by implementing improvements in biosafety, biosecurity, and biorisk management. And he has advanced and promoted persons who are associated, closely associated, with the worst of the previous National Institutes of Health management of biosafety, biosecurity, and biorisk management. You heard from Bryce that Jeffrey Taubenberger was directly and personally and individually involved in resurrecting the 1918 influenza virus, the pandemic influenza virus, from that period, which infected almost everyone on the planet and killed 1% of the population of the planet, a virus that had been extinct since that time, and for which immunity in most of the world's population had waned or been lost completely. So this is a person who is personally and directly involved in what would be considered dangerous gain-of-function research, who has actively and ardently supported dangerous gain-of-function research. And in his position at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases as a senior advisor to Anthony Fauci, the director of that institute, participated in supporting what is now defined as dangerous gain-of-function research, supported directly the cover-up of the origins of COVID-19, authored a paper with Peter Daszak of EcoHealth Alliance and David Morins, another senior advisor to Anthony Fauci, attempting to suppress information about the origins of COVID-19 and to defraud the global public and global policymakers about the origin. This is not a person that you turn to in order to turn over a fresh leaf and change management at NIAID. This is a person who represents continuity with the worst aspects of NIAID under Anthony Fauci. You asked what Jay Bhattacharya has said. Jay Bhattacharya has said that he's talked to Jeffrey Taubenberger and believes that Jeffrey Taubenberger has changed his views. Essentially, he looked into his eyes and saw his soul and believes he can work with him.
Very scientific. Very scientific indeed.
I am willing. I was willing when that statement was first made, I was willing to see how things would play out, what changes would occur. What is striking is that the changes have not occurred. An executive order, I believe in May, called for an end to U.S. funding for dangerous gain-of-function research. That was an important advance. It was followed within a day by the NIH issuing a directive, a notice, a formal notice, that it was ending new funding for dangerous gain-of-function research and suspending current funding. That was another important step. But the follow-through has been absent. The expectations were high. The follow-through has been very limited. In order to carry that out, you need to have a means of identifying dangerous gain-of-function research grants, identifying the parts of the NIH portfolio, currently funded grants, that meet the definition. You need to identify those that meet the definition, and then you need to suspend them. Research continues to be supported at NIH with the full endorsement of Taubenberger, the acting director of NIH, and with the full endorsement of Bhattacharya, the director of the NIH. The reason they continue to be funded is that the process used to identify, flag, and suspend currently funded grants was ineffective. Taubenberger assigned NIAID program officers, they're called program officers. They are assigned responsibility for sets of current grants and management of those grants to review their portfolios and identify and flag any that would meet the definition of dangerous gain of function research. NIAID program managers from the parts of NIAID that fund research on bacteria, research on protozoa, and research on fungi did this. The program officers from virology did not. They simply failed to identify or refused to identify or actively obstructed the identification and flagging of proposals. And the key virology gain of function research grants, the ones that pose highest risk, were not identified, were not flagged, and were not suspended. This information is has been brought to the attention of the NIH director again and again and again. His response is to insist it didn't occur.
So everything's going well, Jenner. So in summary, Richard's super happy with the progress of everything.
Let's talk groceries, specifically your groceries, with Instacart. You want your groceries just the way you like them, right? Well, the Instacart app lets you do just that. They have a new preference picker that lets you pick how ripe or unripe you want your bananas. Shoppers can see your preferences up front, helping guide their choices. Instacart, get groceries just how you like.
Do you think that it's unrealistic that all gain of function could ever be halted in the world? I mean, that seems totally unrealistic. But even in the United States, do you feel like it could ever happen?
I certainly feel it could happen. And the key point here is that the research has no applications apart from offensive bioweapons development. The research has no applications outside defense. It has no applications for and no use for, and has never been used for, development of a vaccine, a therapeutic agent, or a protective protocol for a pathogen of concern. So it has no interest whatsoever to industry or commercial developers. It's not performed in the private sector by industry or commercial developers unless they are defense-oriented. All applications are for defense, and they are not defensive applications. They are development of offensive biological weapons units. The research does not provide information that can be used for developing countermeasures or defenses. It has no defensive value. Its only value is to deter, to develop a new biological weapon, an offensive biological weapon that theoretically could be used to deter an attack, or to develop a new offensive biological weapon that could be used to carry out an attack. And the claim of deterrence is not well supported. It's not well supported precisely because it is extremely difficult and in some cases impossible to attribute an attack. So for example, we talked today about Newcastle disease virus in wild birds. We know that those wild birds were found in China, but it cannot be ascertained whether the release of the virus infecting those birds occurred in China or elsewhere on migration routes. And it certainly cannot be identified which laboratory in any given location was the origin. And so when you can't attribute an attack, can't identify an attack, and can't identify an attacker, deterrence has no value. It has no effect.
So there's something you just said that I think it would be nice to unpack. So heading out of doing this project, this film, my own, I would say summary of all the investigations you all did, I can't really take credit for the fact-finding. It was the work of most of you over the last 20 years. What I can say is that heading out of it, it felt like bird flu was a significant risk, and that that an outbreak could escalate. And there were a lot of sort of cases with bird flu in milk and other things as the film was ending. And then as the time went on, we saw the big incident, which was the avian flu in chickens and the destruction of most of the poultry in the country, and this, you know, egg prices and chicken prices going through the roof. And ultimately, from my understanding, an mRNA vaccine being used on the chickens to help curb this outbreak. Do you look at any of this with a cynical eye, or the timing of it? Do you see any connection to what happened in the United States? Or
when I look at Newcastle disease virus, also a poultry virus and wild bird virus, those have all of the earmarks, all of the hallmarks of being natural events, of being non-deliberate, non-intentional events, where if there is a release from a laboratory, it was an accidental release. But the second most likely option would be a deliberate release by someone intentionally seeking to release that virus and implicate the laboratory. And I guess, well, the broader thing moving, actually the way I probably should have responded to that question was to say that the hazards provided, the hazards posed by dangerous gain-of-function research and research in high-level biocontainment laboratories with high-consequence pathogens include not only accidental release, but also deliberate release. We have a clear precedent for deliberate release in 2001, the anthrax mailings in the United States, mailed to journalists and to politicians. Those anthrax mailings, according to the FBI in the United States, were perpetrated by an authorized biodefense researcher, an Army biodefense researcher, whose contract and grant for anthrax vaccine development was terminated in 2001 summer, and who then distributed anthrax spores through the mails to journalists and politicians seeking to emphasize the importance of biodefense and the importance of renewing funding for anthrax vaccines. That scenario seems to have been the origin of that case. That was a deliberate release. That deliberate release, ironically, prompted the immense expansion of the biodefense enterprise in the United States and following that worldwide. And in many ways, it only has made that risk of a deliberate release more likely, and at the same time, made the risk of an accidental release more likely. It's hard to separate the two. Any facility that you build, any person that you hire with authorized access becomes a possible point for accidental release and also a possible point for deliberate release. And I would say not only a point for accidental deliberate release, but also a point, a target for a false flag attack involving deliberate release, attempting to implicate that facility and those persons as the source of the release.
Right. So I'm wondering, just kind of getting back to what happened around the time of the election and after, there was this avian flu in chickens, the price, the entire inventory was culled, basically. Most of it was culled. Prices went through the roof for eggs and poultry. Do you believe that there was anything nefarious that happened there?
No, I believe that that was an outbreak which had been growing in multiple locations, had all of the earmarks of being natural in origin, with multiple foci on multiple continents of multiple isolates spreading. There's no indication that this would be the kind of incident we saw in Wuhan, or that is being seen in Spain, where there is a release from a single site of a single strain. So it is, I don't think there's any reason to believe that the avian influenza was anything other than a natural outbreak.
But just to be clear, Richard, even though this, you know, appears to be completely and totally natural, there is incentive, just like releasing a pathogen to a human population for, you know, either mass destruction or social control or election disruption or any of the theories for why this COVID could have been functional as an intentional release or to drive a new product. There is the same motivation and possibility that livestock can be the target of an intentional release for market reasons.
I was just
saying
that just moments ago, that not only the possibility, I think that any adversary has already considered this option, already is aware of this option, and is planning this option. It is an invitation, a giant target painted on our backs to build a laboratory that works on a livestock pathogen with bioweapons consequence in the United States. It is almost begging for an adversary or a market manipulator or a combination thereof at the state level or the sub-state level or even at the individual level to carry out a deliberate assault on U.S. Agricultural production. And I have to emphasize that the reason I say livestock is that livestock infections, particularly of livestock that don't fly, are localized. They stay in a given country. This is different, very different, as we know, from Wuhan and COVID-19. If you have an aerosol-transmitted human virus, humans fly in airplanes. The virus leaves the first location and infects the world. That would not happen with a foot-and-mouth disease virus. If one wished to build a bioweapon that actually had military value, that military bioweapon is one that can be targeted to a location. And that means a livestock virus rather than a human aerosol-transmitted virus.
So I want to kind of shift focus into the COVID origin investigation. And one thing that I feel was a potential hypothesis of origin that existed when we were initially discussing this and when the facts were surfacing has come into a little bit more focus. And I know that I personally received contact from emergency room nurses who said that in North Carolina in August that they were treating people who had what they believe were all the symptoms of COVID, and that we now are kind of shifting focus. Some people are shifting focus into asking a very provocative question, which is, did the pandemic originate, you know, in a U.S. lab, and was China somewhat framed or brought into the outbreak as a way of diffusing the true origin and the true accident? What are your thoughts on that hypothesis?
I don't think that's the case. What you're describing is an example of a false flag, is an example of a scenario for a false flag attack. So it is not outside the realm of possibility, but I don't believe that that is what has occurred.
So you're talking about August of 2019, I guess.
I
don't think the virus was anywhere on the planet outside China in August 2019. I believe the virus was actually constructed in China. There's no reason to believe it was constructed in the U.S.
By the way, Richard, you're going to get accused of being part of the cover-up now for having that. There we go.
No. Well, I think that there's something interesting. So I was speaking with Andrew Huff recently, and he was asked to put a proposal together for Tulsi Gabbard as far as the origins investigation goes and disclosure. And he had mentioned that the first thing that should be done would be tissue samples in areas that we could essentially control. We can't control tissue samples or serological samples out of China. And I know for the most part that the serological data that may exist has never been disclosed, only the sequence, or at least it wasn't originally. But there's been an avoidance to collect tissue samples in areas that have had some suspected outbreak, telltale signs of outbreak earlier than we ever would have figured.
It should be straightforward that samples that exist in the U.S. should be analyzed. It also is straightforward and should not be a matter of debate that all of the laboratory records and correspondence from U.S. laboratories that were working on coronaviruses before 2020 should be released. Analyzed and investigated. So the fact that that investigation hasn't occurred to date is unfortunate, and that can be corrected. Some of the information may not still exist as of 2025, 2026, but it is certainly the case that the laboratory records, laboratory notes, laboratory samples, archives, environmental sampling and serological sampling from the Barrick Lab and other labs like it that were working on coronaviruses in the U.S. before 2020 should be obtained, should be released, and should be analyzed. This is important for understanding what happened. It certainly is important for setting a standard internationally of how one investigates an outbreak. The United States can't point to China as refusing to release information and share records if the United States fails to do so itself.
But just taking a basic sort of an Occam's razor approach, why wouldn't you release the information? Why wouldn't you immediately do tissue samples in any around all of the labs that could have been handling this potentially handling this pathogen based on their connections?
No researcher and no research funder wants to set a precedent that their labs will be subject to review. But the point is, if there are going to be facilities working in this area, they need to be subject to review. And if one can't bring oneself to allow review, then you cannot have the laboratory. It's as simple as that.
Okay.
Well, the incentives are just not there, Jenner.
For the United States government to understand the origins of COVID, why would it not take tissue samples in any suspicious, places? Right. And so why have they not?
Yeah, they should. No incentives. They don't. It's better to not know.
So you guys are acknowledging that there is a probability that the tissue samples could reveal a very damning narrative
to the United States? And the lack of incentive that no one, and this is where now we extend beyond researchers, no one wants their papers and their persons to be subject to investigation without probable cause. And so in the absence of probable cause, we actually have an amendment to the Constitution, number 4th Amendment, that provides security in one's person and papers.
Not papers. I'm not talking about laboratories. I'm talking about why not take tissue samples in areas that could have had an outbreak.
Tissue samples and blood samples are even more stringent in terms of protection on privacy than provided under the 4th Amendment to the Constitution for person and papers. So there are major obstacles to performing such investigations. I nevertheless think that it would be desirable for them to be performed. And if it's not possible to get permission from the parties, from the laboratories to have them perform, we can't continue to have those laboratories. We can't continue to support those laboratories. So if a laboratory will insist on its right to proprietary information and its right to privacy and its right to privacy of samples, that's not a laboratory that can be funded to work with high consequence pathogens. But Kurt,
God,
by the way, maybe a silver lining of Jeffrey Taubenberger's appointment is he is very interested in, digging up tissues and, getting out of
not for the same purpose.
Maybe he's the right guy.
Well, Halloween has come and gone, but the grave digging aspect. The season has passed for it. But
Jenner. Right. So the thing is, it always seems like there's some potentially nefarious or suspicious reason.
Yeah, because there is. Because why would the government want to expose what the government's done wrong? The United States has conveniently been able to blame China for this, but obviously we funded the research for years and
we have made very little acknowledgement of the direct enabling support from the United States government to the research in Wuhan. Even when the NIH director, the new NIH director, Jay Bhattacharya, said that the United States funded research related to this, he would not go to the step of saying that the NIH funded research that was directly on the pathway of producing the virus. So the United States has not acknowledged that point, and without acknowledging that point, certainly wouldn't call for investigation of its own laboratories. It won't even acknowledge facts that have been fully established and easily are established by public documents.
You're a pro at running your life, at committing to your workout, at showing up every day. At Bombas, we're pros too. Pros at making socks. Our sport assortment has specialized socks for whatever sport you're committed to. Running, hiking, golf, Pilates, and so much more. Made with sweat-wicking yarns, blister-fighting details, and targeted arch support. Bombas Sport is pro-level socks from the pros of socks. For another pro, you. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code audio for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com and use code audio.
So let's focus for a second on Fauci. So the last time we spoke was before the election, I believe. And of course, a lot of things, and a lot of things have happened since then. Why don't we start with just, I guess, the pardon and take me through from your vantage, all of the pertinent breaks on Anthony Fauci and why they're important.
Well, the single most important event since we spoke, I believe we spoke in January of 2024. So it has been quite some time. So almost 11 months before the election, a year before the preemptive pardon to Anthony Fauci. The key development in that period was the AutoPen preemptive pardon. The preemptive pardon removes Fauci from a target of prosecution for events and actions of the past. And there has been discussion of voiding the pardon, but the likelihood is high that this removes the possibility of prosecution for actions carried out before the pardon.
What else has happened as far as the investigation into Fauci, the Senate or the House committees or anything else that I think would put the spotlight on justice? I mean, a lot of people watch this movie and they go, well, how is this man going to be brought to justice? Is there anything that's happened?
Substantial additional information has been obtained demonstrating his violations of law. And information has been obtained in the form of a cell phone, which was surrendered. Information has been obtained in the form of communications, which were previously unreleased, which have been turned over to congressional investigators. The information provides additional evidence that takes a case that was already provable beyond reasonable doubt and provides additional evidence piling on to that proof beyond reasonable doubt. But with a preemptive pardon, AutoPen or not AutoPen, prosecution for actions before the pardon is highly improbable.
And so do you believe that Fauci will ever be brought to justice? And is there any pathway to bring him to justice at this point or angle of criminal liability, even in perjury, that
A pardon that is in place provides protection from federal prosecution for crimes committed before the pardon. It provides no protection for federal crimes committed after the pardon. So if he is brought to testify and perjures himself again in testimony, he will be prosecuted or prosecutable for that perjury. It also provides no protection against state prosecution. If a state attorney general or a state prosecutor or even a local prosecutor brought charges, those charges could be brought even for actions committed before the pardon.
So, for example,
and it provides no protections for a prosecution from courts outside by entities outside the United States.
So, for example, a very sort of friendly to the cause of creating justice and prosecuting Fauci, a state like Texas or Florida or a quote red state that has an attorney general in place could charge him. What do you feel the state charge could be that would stick enough to proceed?
That is outside my area of expertise.
But sort of the same crimes that he would have faced at a federal level,
yes,
that a state could charge, yes, him with those crimes against its residents for affecting...
Correct.
Its
Correct.
Residents and looking at however many deaths there were in the states and lost jobs and
that is my
things of that nature. What did you make?
But Jenner, there's no incentives to do
this.
Yes,
there is. Like, I mean, there's clearly an incentive.
The incentives are to talk about doing something and not do it. You get a lot of, like, people have been talking about this for a long time and nothing happened, right? I mean, what So I think, Richard, you're talking about Rand Paul recently is saying he wants to depose Fauci
written a letter to Fauci inviting him to voluntarily appear before the committee. Any false statement made in that appearance would give rise to a lying to Congress charge, effectively a congressional perjury charge, and would potentially...
So he has a Sophie's choice.
He was invited, right? And was informed that if he did not accept the invitation and schedule an appearance before the end of November 2025, he would be subpoenaed. And then the government shutdown occurred, which gave him a grace period. And so I believe the dates have been extended, but I do believe that he will choose not to appear voluntarily and that he will then be subpoenaed and then he will appear. If he appears, he will have basically three options. He could testify truthfully. That's an option I'm certain he would not take. He could testify falsely, which he has done in the past. I think that's an option he would not take. Or he could call upon his Fifth Amendment right to avoid self-incrimination.
I thought you cannot plead the Fifth if you've been pardoned, that you have to testify.
Oh, that's right. So he cannot plead the Fifth for events prior to, for actions taken prior to the pardon, but he can plead the Fifth for other subjects.
So if he was brought in and he has to testify about what actually happened, knowing that he can never be federally held responsible for it, mm-hmm. it would form the basis for state cases and potentially an international case against him.
Possibly. And more importantly, it would provide the basis for cases against his co-conspirators.
Who have not been pardoned and will not be pardoned.
It's unfortunate that I made an important error when I said there were three options. He could testify truthfully, he could testify falsely, or he could take the Fifth. There is, of course, a fourth option, and that is he could cite his age and suggest that he has forgotten. And that would be the response for anything in the past. And so I would expect that that would be the response now, particularly with two extra years under his belt to claim larger lapse of time and greater lapse of memory.
Let's pivot in the last sort of movement here. And the question is, there's some interest at Angel, and I think with all the people who've seen it, in a sequel of sorts. What do you think should be in the second film? Assuming we start right now and kind of look back at wherever the story ended, plus things that were left out or things that are most pressing, what do you think should be in the second film?
That is the challenge.
Right. So do you feel like there are things that you would like to see explored other than, of course, justice for Fauci, but sort of other damning information or other players who completely got off in the first part?
Absolutely. So accountability is important, but it is the most important element of accountability is establishing what happened. Full details. The United States Congress, both the House and the Senate, voted unanimously. And President Biden at the time, signed into law legislation that requires all U.S. intelligence on the subject of COVID origin that does not compromise intelligence gathering sources to be released. The deadline for that elapsed several years ago. The Biden administration chose not to follow that law, chose to blatantly violate that law. The second Trump administration chose to flagrantly violate that law. I would like to see compliance with that law. We need to have that information released, and we also need to have full information released as promised by the HHS secretary and by the NIH director about HHS NIH funding for the research. We also need information released about USAID funding for the research. None of this information has been released under two Trump administrations and one Biden administration.
So what about, go ahead, Bryce. Sorry, I want to hear your voice.
But this, your question was about a sequel. What should a sequel be? And that, Richard has just talked about something that would be boring. Let's be honest.
But they'll know that's not boring. That's important. Information is important.
As a movie,
well, it's what we find in the information that's going to be entertaining.
Yes, yeah. What we find in the information can be used to drive accountability for the many U.S. government officials who participated and do not have preemptive pardons.
Okay, so I think that, I guess the last thing would be, obviously, the research that has happened even in years past still poses this existential risk, including the research that was supposed to be shut down that hasn't been shut down. What do you think is the most probable source of the next big one, so to speak? What should we really be scared of based on projects that have occurred over the years and that pose the biggest threat to humanity?
The one that was obvious in 2015 already as the highest threat and identified as the highest threat at an international meeting on biosafety and biorisk management was the coronavirus project being carried out jointly by the Barrick Lab and Wuhan Institute of Virology. So at that point in time, in 2015, it was possible to put a finger on one project that was of higher consequence than any else being performed in the on the planet. And the identification was correct. Today, there are so many occurring in so many locations that it's hard to single out one. I continue to be concerned about high pathogenicity avian influenza virus projects. I continue to be concerned about coronavirus projects. I now have additional concerns and newer concerns, enhanced concerns about henepavirus projects. That's hendravirus and Nipah virus.
Oof, yeah, those are bad ones.
Those ones have very high case fatality rates and are growing in interest, attention, and effort on the kind of research that poses high risk, and not just in the United States, but in multiple nations.
Wasn't there a recent paper published sort of celebrating the fact that a coronavirus had been made to perform at 90% fatality rate to humans? Like, wasn't that something that just happened? Does that ring a bell, Bryce?
Yeah, that's just one. You may be thinking of a recent paper that comes from Wuhan Institute of Virology and the Guangzhou Laboratory in Guangdong. And that was on a coronavirus. It involved exactly the same kind of research that was being performed in Wuhan on the SARS virus, on bat SARS-related viruses, by the same personnel, many of the same personnel, almost certainly at the same time in 2019, on a different category of coronavirus called the SADS-related coronaviruses.
And that just happened, that research.
That causes high lethality to swine, not to humans.
Got it.
But it was exactly the same kind of project, creating new and enhanced versions of an agricultural bioweapons agent that could be used in deliberate attacks to disrupt agricultural production and economies in a country, and which would remain in the targeted nation.
Also, Richard, you didn't mention one of the things that's noteworthy about that swine flu outbreak in Spain is the virologist cover story for that. The sausage sandwich story.
When there is a lab escape or a lab release, the go-to cover story is bad meat. And so bad meat was the explanation for the anthrax spore release in 1979 in the Soviet Union at Sverdlovsk. Bad meat, or actually with the change of one letter to bat meat, mm-hmm. was the explanation for SARS-CoV-2 in Wuhan. And bad meat, again, comes in as the virologist's preferred explanation of the African swine fever virus outbreak in Spain. The suggestion was that a foreign, and that's between two versions of it, the one was a foreign cold cut sandwich that was contaminated, may have been discarded in a park and eaten by the wild boars, and the other was that a foreign sausage sandwich was discarded in the park and eaten by the boars. And so the bad meat is now differentiated into either cold cuts or coryza, but basic same story.
Well, that is tantalizing
yes.
and sensational. So Bryce, you've got 10 minutes. I want your best monologue.
First of all, I have great ideas for the sequel, as you know, we've discussed. Huff, Rixie, all I have to say. That's it. That's your story. Follow them, just track them. The alternative would be follow maybe I or Richard or both of us launch Senate campaigns to take on Cory Booker. And our only position is just that we are going to release all the files and like have Fauci come, you know, how about that?
It's sort of an Epstein file campaign for COVID. Yeah, that,
but we're not going to win. You just record and just we do a bunch of campaigns.
I defer to Bryce on that campaign. You may take the lead on that.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. Actually, the real substantive thing I'll say is something we kind of glossed over a little bit, which is this idea that like it's inevitable. We have to do this research and we're going to make sure we do it in these protected, you know, government facilities. So the position that you said Andrew Huff holds, right? So, and I said, well, Richard and I don't hold that opinion. We think that this research should never be done under any circumstances. There's no value to it. That's fundamentally the fight that's going on in the government right now as it relates to this, you know, gain of function policy. So all indications are, you know, that the executive order is supposed to result in a policy that will, you know, then be implemented across all the agencies in the U.S. government. And it really is the case that there will be, you know, there will be people that think there needs to be little cutouts that will allow the U.S. to do some of this research. And the argument will be that if we don't do, you know, our adversaries are doing it, we need to be able to like, you know, have the ability to do this at some super safe locations and whatnot. It's a matter of principle. It's a matter of what people truly believe. So when individuals say this work should not be done or talk about the danger of it, Richard talks about it, I talk about it, we are speaking in absolutes. So be very careful when you also speak to other people who talk about the dangers of it, but then say, well, other people are going to be doing it, so we should be able to do it too. Like, it's inevitable. I don't think it's inevitable. I think if there's a will, there's a way. And there clearly isn't enough there aren't enough people in the current administration that understand or at least have the view. I guess they may understand the existential risk, but they do not have the same view that Richard and I do. And I think Kennedy has the same view that you can't do this. You simply can't do it. It's too dangerous to do it, no matter where you're doing it. It shouldn't be done anywhere. That, unfortunately, I think will win the day.
I want to speak to the inevitable point and in a way that's directly relevant to Jenner and the films. This never was inevitable. Had there not been an Anthony Fauci, or had Dick Cheney not assigned Anthony Fauci responsibility for U.S. bioweapons agent research, this category of research, dangerous gain of function, which has no scientific informational value, no civilian applications, no defensive military applications, would never have been performed in the U.S. And had it never been performed in the U.S., it never would have been performed elsewhere. The person who removed the genie from the bottle was Anthony Fauci. And so if we could remove him historically from the scene, this would not have been inevitable. It would not even have occurred once. So if you have a Terminator in your next movie.
Right.
If you have time travel.
It's not time travel.
Movie,
yeah, of course.
Yes, well, you can send someone back to solve this problem.
But either that or can, yeah, we can do a quantum sort of leap into another universe, a baby universe. Yeah.
Huff might be able to supply information on the newest technologies for nano time travel.
Yes, yes.
Now
or interdimensional travel. Interdimensional travel
yes,
to
it's
another universe.
My area, so I can't say.
But so, Richard, we're in 2025 now, right? So here we are in the post.
For just a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
So for just a little bit. And the point is that moving forward, I am saying that if you allow these the people to say it's inevitable, we have to do it, it's never going to be stopped.
Then that is self-reinforcing. If you say it's inevitable, it will be inevitable and it will be done in every nation. And we will have a laboratory-generated pandemic on an annual or semi-annual basis.
And that's where we're headed. That's literally where we're headed.
Thanks for listening to Leaked, a podcast inspired by the documentary Thank You, Dr. Fauci. If you want to see the full story, the interviews, the evidence, and more, check out the documentary streaming now on Angel Studios. Visit angel.com. Leaked is a production of Tenderfoot Labs, produced in partnership with Insight Studios, Angel Studios, and Bombadil Productions. Producers on behalf of Insight Studios are Jenna First, Louis Fenton, Scott St. John, and Arnold Rifkin. Executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot Labs are Donald Albright, Payne Lindsay, and Alex Vespestead. Tenderfoot Labs' lead producer is Tristan Bankston. Editing by Liam Luxon. Associate editors are Miles Clark and Cameron Taggy. Coordinating producers are John Street and Jordan Foxworthy. Artwork by Where Eagles Dare. Music by Danielle First, Kyrie Mateen, and Jay Ragsdale. Mixed by Dayton Cole. For more podcasts like Leaked, search Tenderfoot TV on your favorite podcast app or visit us at tenderfoot.tv. Thanks for listening.